stop now, it's over. If there had been riotous clapping, I couldn't hear it any longer. It seemed to have stopped. I only felt the piano player patting me, two quick pats, on my back, which was sticky and cold with the dried sweat of the previous club. I opened my eyes. Yes, the uproar in the bar was over. Or maybe it had never been. Everything looked as it had before. The piano player was already talking to the next performer. The bachelorettes were happily drinking and talking as if nothing had happened at all. It was 2:30 in the morning. Amy was not in her seat. She was not in the bar. I stumbled around that cramped and crowded space twice, kicked open each stall in the awful toilets, my phone at my ear, ringing and ringing and getting her answer phone. I struggled back through the bar and up the stairs to the street. I was making yelping noises of panic. It was raining and my hair, which had been blow-dried straight, now began to curl back up with terrific speed. Every raindrop that hit me spurred a curl, and I reached into it and felt lamb's wool, the damp spring of it, thick and alive. A car horn went. I looked up and saw Errol parked where we had left him. The back window went down and Amy leant out of it, slow clapping. Oh, bravo! I hurried to her, apologizing. She opened the door. Just get in. I sat next to her, still apologizing. She shifted forward to speak to Errol. Drive to Midtown and back. Errol took off his glasses and pinched the bridge of his nose. It's almost 3, I said, but the partition went up and off we went. For 10 blocks or so, Amy said nothing at all, and neither did I. As we passed through Union Square, she turned to me. Are you happy? What? Answer the question. I don't understand why I'm being asked the question. She licked her thumb and wiped the mascara I had not realized was running down my face. We've been together, what, 5 years? Almost 7. Okay. So you should know by now that I don't want the people who work for me, she explained slowly as if talking to an idiot, to be unhappy working for me. I don't see the point in that. But I'm not unhappy. Then what are you? Happy. She took the cap off her head and pulled it over mine. In this life, she said, falling back against the leather, you've got to know what you want. You have to visualize it, and then you have to pull it down. But we've talked about this many times. Many times. I nodded and smiled, too drunk to manage much more. I had my face wedged between the walnut and the window, and from here I had a fresh view of the city from the top down. I'd see the roof garden of a penthouse before I saw the few stray people still out at this hour, splashing through puddle sidewalks, and I kept finding in this perspective uncanny, paranoid alignments. An old Chinese lady, a can collector in an old-fashioned conical hat, pulling her load, hundreds, perhaps thousands, of cans gathered together in a huge plastic sheet. Under the windows of a building I knew to contain a Chinese billionaire, a friend of Amy's, with whom she had once discussed opening a chain of hotels. And in this city, you really need to know what it is you want, Amy was saying. But I don't think you do know yet. Okay, so you're smart. We get that. You think what I'm saying doesn't apply to you, but it does. The brain is connected to the heart and the eye. It's all visualization, all of it. Want it, see it, take it. No apologies. I don't apologize ever for what I want. But I see you, and I see that you spend your life apologizing. It's like you've got survivor's guilt or something. But we're not in Bendigo anymore. You've left Bendigo, right? Like Baldwin left Harlem, like Dylan left wherever the fuck it was he was from. Sometimes you gotta get out, get the fuck out of Bendigo. Thanks be to Christ we both have. Long ago. Bendigo's behind us. You get what I'm saying, right? I nodded many times over, though I had no idea what she was saying, really. Apart from the strong sense I usually had with Amy, that she found her own story universally applicable, and never more so than when drunk. That in these moments, we all of us came from Bendigo, and we all of us had fathers who had died when we were young, and we had all visualized our good fortune and pulled it down towards us. The border between Amy and everybody else became obscure, hard to make out exactly. I felt sick. I hung my head like a dog into the New York night. "Look, you're not going to be doing this forever," I heard her say a little later, as we entered Times Square, driving beneath an 80-foot Somali model with a 2-foot afro dancing for joy on the side of a building in her perfectly ordinary Gap khakis. "That's just fucking obvious. So the question becomes, what are you going to do after this? What are you going to do with your life?" I knew the right answer to this was meant to be run my own this or that, or something amorphously creative like write a book or open a yoga retreat. For Amy thought that in order to do these sorts of things, a person only had to walk into, say, a publisher's office and announce their intent. This had been her own experience. What could she know about the waves of time that simply come at a person, one after the other? What could she know about life as the temporary, always partial, survival of that process? I fixed my eyes on the dancing Somali model. "I'm fine. I'm happy." "Well, I think you're too much in your own head," she said, tapping hers. "Maybe you need to get laid more. You know, you never do seem to get laid. I mean, is it my fault? I set you up, don't I? All the time, you never tell me how it goes." Light flooded the car. It came from a huge digital ad for something or other, but inside the car it felt delicate and natural, like the break of day. Amy rubbed her eyes. "Well, I've got projects for you," she said. "If you want projects. We all know you're capable of more than you're doing. At the same time, if you want to jump ship, now would be a good time to do it. I'm serious about this African project. No, don't roll your eyes at me. We need to iron out details, of course. I know that. I'm not a fool. But it's gonna happen. Judy's been talking to your mom. I know you don't want to hear that either, but she has, and your mother is not as full of shit as you seem to think she is. Judy feels that the zone... well, I'm loaded right now, and I can't remember where it is right now. Tiny country in the West. But she thinks that might be a really interesting direction for us to go in. It's got potential," says Judy. "And turns out, your honorable member of a mother knows a lot about it," says Judy. "Point is, I'm gonna need all hands on deck and people who want to be here," she said, indicating her own heart. "Not people who are still wondering why they're here." "I want to be there," I said, looking at the spot, though under the influence of vodka her little breasts doubled themselves, then crossed, then merged.
"I turn now?"
asked Errol, hopefully, through a microphone. Amy sighed. "You turn now." "Well," she said, returning to me, "you've been acting screwy for months. Since London. It's a lot of bad energy. It's the kind of bad energy that really needs to be grounded. Otherwise, it just keeps passing round the circuit, affecting everybody." She made a series of hand gestures here that suggested some previously unknown law of physics. "Something happened in London." 3. By the time I'd finished answering her, we'd looped back and reached Union Square, where I looked up and saw the number on that huge ticking board speeding forward, billowing smoke out of the Dantean red hole at its center. It gave me a breathless feeling. A lot of things that happened in those months in London had made me breathless. I'd finally given up my flat for lack of use, and stood at a crowded hustings, waiting all night to watch a man in a blue tie ascend the stage and concede victory to my mother in a red dress. I'd seen a flyer for a nostalgic 90s hip-hop night at the Jazz Cafe and wanted urgently to go, but could not think of a single friend I might take. I'd simply travelled too much the past few years, was not on any of the usual sites, did not keep up with personal email, partly out of lack of time, and partly because Amy frowned on our socialising online, fearing loose talk and leaks. Without really noticing it, I'd let my friendships wither on the vine. So I went alone, got drunk, and ended up sleeping with one of the doormen, a huge American from Philadelphia, who claimed to have once played professional basketball. Like most people in his line of work, like Granger, he had been hired for his height and his color, for the threat considered implicit in their combination. 2 minutes of smoking a cigarette with him revealed a gentle soul on good terms with the universe, ill-suited to his role. I had a little pouch of coke on me, given to me by Amy Sheff, and when my doorman's break came, we went to the bathroom stalls and took a lot of it, off a shiny ledge behind the toilet that seemed specifically designed for the purpose. He told me that he hated his job, the aggression, dreaded laying hands on anyone. We left together after his shift, giggling in the taxi as he massaged my feet. When we got back to my flat, in which everything was packed up in boxes, ready for Amy's huge storage facility in Marylebone, he got hold of the aspirational pull-up bar that I'd put up above my bedroom door and never used, attempted a pull-up and ripped the stupid thing from the wall, and part of the plaster, too. In bed, though, I could hardly feel him inside of me, shriveled up by the coke, maybe. He didn't seem to mind. Cheerfully, he fell asleep on top of me like a big bear, and then, with equal cheeriness, at around 5 a.m, wished me well and let himself out. I woke up in the morning with a nosebleed, and the very clear sense that my youth, or at least this version of it, was over. 6 weeks later, on a Sunday morning, as Judy and Amy frenetically texted me about the archiving, in Milan, of a portion of Amy's stage wardrobe, years 92 to 98, I sat, unbeknownst to them both, in the walk-in clinic of the Royal Free Hospital, awaiting the results of an STD and AIDS test, listening to several people, far less lucky than I turned out to be, being taken into side rooms to weep. But I didn't speak to Amy of any of this. Instead, I was speaking of Tracy. Tracy, of all people. The whole history of us, the chronology sliding woozily back and forth in time and vodka, all resentments writ large, pleasures either diminished or destroyed, and the longer I spoke, the clearer I saw and understood, as if the truth were a sunken thing rising up through a well of vodka to meet me, that only one thing had happened in London, really. I'd seen Tracy. After so many years of not seeing Tracy, I had seen her. None of the rest mattered. It was as if nothing in the period between the last time I saw her and this had happened at all. "Wait, wait," said Amy, too drunk herself to disguise her impatience with another person's monologue. "This is your oldest girlfriend, right?"
"Yes, I know this. Did I meet her?"
"Never."
"And she's a dancer?"
"Yes."
"Best type of people. Their bodies tell them what to do."
I had been sitting on the edge of my seat, but now I deflated and lay my head back on its cold corner pillow of blacked-out glass, walnut and leather.
"Well, you can't make old friends,"
announced Amy, in such a way that you might have assumed the phrase originated with her.
"What would I do without my dear old Jude? Since we were 15. She fucked the dude I took to the school dance. But she calls me on my shit. Yes, she does. No one else does that."
I was used to Amy turning all stories about me into stories about her. Usually, I simply deferred to it, but the drink had me bold enough to believe, at that moment, that both our lives were in fact of equal weight, equally worthy of discussion, equally worthy of time. "It was after I had that lunch with my mother," I explained slowly. "The night I went out with that Daniel guy? In London? The disaster date." Amy frowned.
"Daniel Kramer?" "I set you up with him, the financial guy. See, you didn't tell me anything about that."
"Well, it was a disaster. We went to see a show, and she was in that fucking show."
"You spoke to her?"
"No, I haven't spoken to her in 8 years. I just told you that. Are you even listening to me?"
Amy put two fingers to her temples.
"The timeline is confusing," she murmured. "Plus, my head hurts.
Look, God, I don't know. Maybe you should call her. Sounds like you want to."
"Call her now. Fuck it. I'll talk to her."
"No!"
She grabbed my phone out of my hand, laughing, scrolling through my contacts, and when I tried to reach for it, she held it out of her window.
Give it to me! Oh, come on, she'll love it!
I managed to climb over her, snatch the phone, and press it between my thighs. You don't understand. She did a terrible thing to me. We were 22, a terrible thing. Amy raised one of her famously geometric eyebrows and sent up the partition that Errol, wanting to know which entrance to the house we were heading for, front or back, had just sent down.
Well, now I'm genuinely interested.
We turned into Washington Square Park. The townhouses around the square stood red and noble, their facades warmly lit. But everything inside the park was dark and dripping, empty of people, aside from the half a dozen homeless black men in the far right corner, sitting on the chess tables, their bodies wrapped in trash bags with holes for the arms and legs. I put my face to the window, closed my eyes, felt the flecks of rain, and told the story as I remembered it, the fiction and the reality, in a jagged, painful rush, as if I were running across broken glass. But when I opened my eyes, it was to the sound of Amy laughing again.
It's not fucking funny!
Wait, are you being serious right now?
She tried pulling her top lip back into her mouth and biting down on it.
You don't think it's possible, she asked, that maybe you're making a big deal out of not so much?
What?
Honestly, the only person I feel sorry for in that scenario, if it's true, is your dad.
Poor guy. Super lonely, trying to get his rocks.
Stop it! It's not like he's Jeffrey Dahmer.
It's not normal. That's not a normal thing to do.
Normal?
Don't you understand that every man in this world with access to a computer, including the president, is right at this moment either looking at vaginas or has just stopped looking at vaginas? It's not the same. It's exactly the same. Except your dad didn't even have a computer.
You think if George W. Bush looks up teen Asian pussy, then what? He's a fucking serial killer?
Well, good point. Bad example. I chuckled, despite myself.
I'm sorry. Maybe I'm being stupid.
I don't get it. Why are you angry, exactly?
Because she told you?
You just said you thought it was bullshit.
It was startling, after so many years of my own twisted logic, to hear the problem ironed out into Amy's preferred straight line. The clarity disturbed me.
She was always lying.
She had this idea my father was perfect, and she wanted to ruin him for me. She wanted to make me hate my father like she hates hers. I couldn't ever really look him in the eye after. And it was that way till he died.
Amy sighed.
That's the stupidest fucking thing I ever heard. You went and made yourself sad for no reason at all.
She reached out to touch my shoulder, but I turned my back on her and wiped a rogue tear from my eye.
Pretty stupid.
No. We all have our shit. You should call your friend, though.
She made a little pillow of her jacket and lay her head against her window, and by the time we'd crossed Sixth Avenue, she was already asleep. She was the queen of power naps. Had to be, to live as she did. 4. Earlier that year in London, a few days before the local elections, I'd had lunch with my mother. It was a grey, humid day. People moved across the bridge joylessly, beaten down by the drizzling rain, and even the grandest monuments, even Parliament, looked grim to me. Sad and underwhelming. It all made me wish we were already in New York. I wanted all that height and sunstruck glass. And then after New York, Miami, and then 5 stops in South America, and finally the European tour, 20 cities, ending in London once again. In this way, a whole year could pass by. I liked it that way. Other people had seasons to get through. They had to drag themselves through each year. In Amy's world, we didn't live like that. We couldn't, even if we'd wanted to. We were never in one place long enough. If we didn't like winter, we flew towards summer. When we were tired of cities, we went to the beach and vice versa. I'm exaggerating a little, not by much. My late 20s had passed in a weird state of timelessness, and I think now that not everyone could have fallen into a life like that, that I must have been somehow primed for it. Later, I wondered whether we were chosen primarily for this reason, exactly because we tended to be people with few external ties, without partners or children, with the very minimum of family. The way we lived certainly kept us that way. Out of Amy's 4 female assistants, only one of us ever had a child, and only then in her mid-40s, long after quitting. Climbing aboard that Learjet, you had to be untethered. It wouldn't have worked otherwise. I had only one rope now, my mother, and she was, like Amy, in her prime, although unlike Amy, my mother had very little need of me. She was flying high herself. A few days from becoming the Member of Parliament for Brent West, and as I turned left, heading towards the Oxo Tower, leaving Parliament behind me, I felt, as usual, my own smallness next to her, the scale of what she had achieved, the frivolousness of my own occupation in comparison, despite all she tried to direct me towards. She seemed more impressive to me than ever. I held tight to the barrier all the way until I was across. It was too damp to sit out on the terrace. I searched the restaurant for several minutes, but then spotted my mother, outside after all, under an umbrella, sheltered from the drizzle, and with Miriam, though there had been no mention in our phone call of Miriam. I didn't dislike Miriam. I didn't have any feeling about her, really. It was hard to have feelings about her. She was so small and quiet and serious. All her dull features were gathered in the middle of her little face, and her natural hair was wound into sister dreads, genteelly greying at their tips. She had a little pair of round, gold-rimmed glasses which she never removed, and made her eyes look even tinier than they were. She wore sensible brown fleeces and plain black trousers no matter the occasion. A human picture frame, her only purpose to set off my mother. All that my mother ever really said about Miriam was, "Miriam makes me happy." Miriam never spoke about herself. She only spoke about my mother. I had to Google her to discover she was Afro-Cuban by way of Lewisham, that once she'd worked in international aid but now taught at Queen Mary's in some very lowly adjunct position, and had been writing a book about the diaspora for longer than I'd known her, which was about 4 years. She was introduced to my mother's constituents with a minimum of fuss at some event in a local school, photographed, tucked into the side of my mother, a timid dormouse standing by her lioness, and the journalist from the Wilsdon and Brent Times got exactly the same line I'd been given. "Miriam makes me very happy." Nobody seemed especially interested, not even the old Jamaican men and the African evangelicals. I got the sense that her constituents did not really think of my mother and Miriam as lovers. They were simply those two nice Wilsdon ladies who had saved the old cinema and fought to expand the leisure centre and established Black History Month throughout the local libraries. Campaigning, they made an effective pair. If you found my mother overbearing, you could take comfort in Miriam's unassuming passivity, while people who were bored by Miriam relished the excitement my mother created wherever she went. Looking at Miriam now, nodding quickly, receptively, as my mother speechified, I knew that I was also glad of Miriam. She was a useful buffer. I went over and put a hand on my mother's shoulder. She did not look up or stop talking, but she registered my touch and raised a hand to lay over mine, accepting the kiss I pressed to her cheek. I drew out a chair and sat down. "How are you, Mum?"
"Stressed."
"Your mother's very stressed," confirmed Miriam, and began quietly to list all the many causes of my mother's stress, the envelopes that had to be stuffed and the flyers yet to be posted, the closeness of the latest polling, the underhand tactics of the opposition, and the supposed double dealing of the only other Black woman in Parliament, an MP of 20 years standing, whom my mother considered for no sensible reason her bitter rival. I nodded in the right places and looked through the menu and managed to order some wine from a passing waiter, all without breaking the flow of Miriam's talk, her numbers and percentages, the careful regurgitations of the various brilliant things my mother had said to so-and-so at this or that vital moment, and how so-and-so had responded poorly to whatever brilliant thing it was my mother had said. "But you're going to win," I said, with an intonation I realized too late was posed awkwardly between statement and question. My mother looked stern, unfolded her napkin and lay it on her lap, like a queen who has been asked impertinently if her people still love her.
"If there's any justice," she said.
Our food arrived. My mother had ordered for me. Miriam set about squirreling hers away. She reminded me of a small mammal who expects to hibernate soon. But my mother let her knife and fork rest where they were, and instead reached down onto the empty chair beside her to bring up a copy of the Evening Standard, already open to a large picture of Amy, on stage, juxtaposed with a stock photo of some destitute African children, from where exactly I couldn't tell. I hadn't seen the piece, and it was held too far from me to read the text, but I guessed the source. A recent press release announcing Amy's commitment to global poverty reduction. My mother tapped a finger on Amy's abdomen. "Is she serious about it?" I considered the question. "She's very passionate about it." My mother frowned and picked up her cutlery. "Poverty reduction. Well, fine. But what's the policy, specifically?"
"She's not a politician, Mum. She doesn't have policies. She has a foundation."
"Well, what is it she wants to do?"
I poured some wine for my mother and made her pause for a moment and clink a glass with me.
"I think it's really a school she wants to build. A girls' school."
"Because if she's serious," said my mother over my reply, "you should advise her that she needs to talk to us, to be in partnership with government in one way or another. Obviously, she has the financial means and the public's attention. That's all good. But without understanding the mechanics, it's just a lot of good intention that goes nowhere. She needs to meet with the relevant authorities."
I smiled to hear my mother referring to herself already as government. The next thing I said so irritated her, she turned and gave her answer to Miriam instead.
"Oh, please. I really wish you wouldn't behave as if I'm asking for some great favor. I have no interest at all in meeting that woman. None at all. Never have had. I was offering some advice. I thought it would be welcome."
"And it's welcome, Mum. Thank you. I mean, really,
you'd think this woman would want to talk to us. We gave her our British passport, after all."
"Well, never mind.
It just seemed, from this," she held up the paper again, "that she had serious intentions. But maybe that's not right. Maybe she just wants to embarrass herself. I wouldn't know. White woman saves Africa. Is that the idea?"
"Very old idea."
"Well, it's your world, not mine, thank God. But she should really speak with Miriam, at least. The fact is, Miriam has a lot of useful contacts. Rural contacts, educational contacts. She's too modest to tell you. She was at Oxfam for a decade, for God's sake. Poverty is not just a headline, my love. It's a lived reality, underground. And education is at the heart of it."
"I know what poverty is, Mum."
My mother smiled sadly and bit down on a forkful of food.
"No, dear. You don't."
My phone, which I had been trying with all the will available to me not to look at, buzzed again. It had buzzed a dozen times since I'd sat down, and now I took it out and tried to move quickly through the backlog, eating with my phone in one hand. Miriam brought up a dull administrative matter with my mother, often her way when she found herself caught up in some argument of ours, but in the middle of dealing with it, my mother became visibly bored.
"You're addicted to that phone. You do know that."
I didn't stop typing, but made my face as calm as I could manage.
"It's work, Mum. This is how people work now."
"You mean, like slaves?"
She ripped a piece of bread in half and offered the smaller section to Miriam, something I'd seen her do before. It was her version of a diet.
"No, not like slaves. Mum, I have a nice life."
She thought about this with her mouth full. She shook her head.
"No, that's not right. You don't have a life. She has a life. She has her men and her children and her career. She has the life. We read about it in the papers.
You service her life. She's a giant sucking thing, sucking your youth, taking up all your..."
To stop her talking, I pushed my chair back and went to the bathroom, lingering at the mirrors for longer than I needed, sending more emails. But when I got back, the conversation continued uninterrupted, as if no time at all had passed. My mother was still complaining, but to Miriam.
All your time. She just starts everything. She's the reason I won't be having any grandchildren.
Mum, my reproductive situation's really got nothing.
You're too close, you can't see it. She's made you suspicious of everybody.
I denied it, but the arrow hit the target. Wasn't I suspicious? Always on guard? Primed for any sign of what Amy and I called, between ourselves, customers? A customer, someone we judged to be using me in the hope of getting close to her. Sometimes, in the early years, if a relationship of mine did manage, despite all the obstacles of time and geography, to putter along for a few months, I would build up a bit of confidence and courage and would introduce whoever it was to Amy. And this was usually a bad idea. The moment he went to the bathroom or out for a cigarette, I'd ask Amy the question, "Customer?" And the answer would come,
"Oh, honey, I'm sorry. Definitely a customer."
Look at the way you treat your old friends. Tracy, you two were practically sisters, grew up together. Now you don't even speak to her.
Mum, you always hated Tracy.
That's not the point. People come from somewhere. They have roots. You've let this woman pull yours right out of the ground. You don't live anywhere. You don't have anything. You're constantly on a plane. How long can you live like that? I don't think she even wants you to be happy. Because then you might leave her, and then where would she be?
I laughed, but the sound I made was ugly, even to me.
She'd be fine. She's Amy. I'm only assistant number one, you know. There are three others. I see. So she can have any amount of people in her life, but you can only have her. No, you don't see.
I looked up from my phone. I'm actually going out with someone tonight, who Amy set me up with. So,
well, that's nice, said Miriam.
Her favorite thing in life was to see a conflict resolved, any conflict. And so my mother was a great resource for her. Everywhere she went, she made conflict, which Miriam then had to resolve. My mother perked up.
Who is he?
You wouldn't know him. He's from New York.
Can't I know his name? Is it a state secret?
Daniel Kramer. His name is Daniel Kramer.
Ah,
said my mother, smiling inscrutably at Miriam, an infuriating look of complicity passed between them.
Another nice Jewish boy.
As the waiter came to clear our plates, the sun appeared in the gunmetal sky. Rainbows passed through the wine glasses onto the wet silverware, through the backs of the Perspex chairs, spreading from Miriam's commitment ring to a linen napkin that sat between the three of us. I refused dessert. Said I had to get going. But as I moved to take my raincoat off the back of the chair, my mother nodded at Miriam, and Miriam passed me a folder, official-looking, ring-bound, with chapters and photographs, lists of contacts, architectural suggestions, a brief history of education in the region, an analysis of the likely media impact, plans for government partnership, and so on.
A viability study.
The sun crept through the grey. A mental fog cleared. I saw that the whole lunch had been for this purpose, really, and I was just a channel through which information was meant to pass to Amy. My mother, too, was a customer. I thanked her for the folder and sat looking at its cover, closed in my lap.
"And how are you feeling?"
asked Miriam, blinking anxiously behind her glasses.
"About your father? The anniversary's Tuesday, isn't it?"
It was so unusual to be asked a personal question during a lunch with my mother, never mind having a date significant to me remembered, that at first I wasn't sure it was addressed to me. My mother, too, looked alarmed. It was painful for us both to be reminded that the last time we'd seen each other had in fact been at the funeral, a full year earlier. Bizarre afternoon. The coffin met the flames. I sat next to my father's children, now adults in their late 30s and 40s, and experienced a replay of the only other time I'd met them. The daughter wept, the son sat back in his chair with his arms folded across his chest, skeptical of death itself, and I, who couldn't cry, once again found them both to be far more convincing children of my father than I had ever been. And yet, in our family, we had never wanted to admit this unlikelihood. We always batted away what we considered to be the banal and prurient curiosity of strangers. But won't she grow up confused? How will she choose between your cultures? To the point that sometimes I felt the whole purpose of my childhood was to demonstrate to the less enlightened that I was not confused and had no trouble choosing. Life is confusing, my mother's imperious rebuff. But isn't there also a deep expectation of sameness between parent and child? I think I was strange to my mother and to my father, a changeling belonging to neither one of them, and although this is, of course, true of all children, in the end, we are not our parents and they are not us, my father's children would have come to this knowledge with a certain slowness, over years, were perhaps only learning it fully at this very moment, as the flames ate the pinewood, whereas I was born knowing it. I have always known it. It is a truth stamped all over my face. But this was all my private drama. Afterwards, at the reception, I realized something larger than my loss had been going on the whole time. Yes, wherever I walked in that crematorium, I heard it. An ambient buzz. Amy, 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 louder than my father's name and more frequent, as people tried to figure out if she was really in attendance. And then, later, when they decided she must have already come and gone, you could hear it again, in mournful echo. Amy, Amy, Amy. I even heard my sister ask my brother if he'd seen her. She was there throughout, hiding in plain sight. A discreet, surprisingly short woman, makeup-free, so pale as to be almost translucent, in a prim tweed suit with blue veins running up her legs, wearing her own natural straight brown hair. "I think I'm going to lay flowers," I said, pointing vaguely across the river towards North London. "Thanks for asking." "One day off work?" said my mother, turning back, joining the train of the conversation at an earlier stop. "The day of his funeral. One day?" "Mum, one day was all I asked for." My mother affected a face of maternal woundedness. "You used to be so close to your father. I know that I always encouraged you to be. I really don't know what happened." For a moment, I wanted to tell her. Instead, I watched a pleasure boat churn up the Thames. A few people sat dotted among the rows of empty seats, looking out at the grey water. I went back to my email. "Those poor boys," I heard my mother say, and when I raised my head from my phone, I found her nodding at Hungerford Bridge as the boat passed under it. At once the same image that I knew was in her mind floated up in my own. Two young men thrown over the railing into the water. The one who lived and the one who died. I shivered and pulled my cardigan more tightly across my chest. "And there was a girl too," added my mother, tipping a fourth sugar into a frothy cappuccino. "I don't think she was even 16. Practically children, all of them. Such a tragedy. They must still be in prison." "Of course they're still in prison. They killed a man." I drew a breadstick from a thin china vase and broke it into quarters. "He's also still dead. Also a tragedy." "I understand that," snapped my mother. "I was in the public gallery almost every day for that case, if you remember." I remembered. I was not long out of the flat, and it had been my mother's habit to call me each evening when she got home from the High Court to tell me the stories, though I didn't ask to hear them, each with its own grotesque sadness, but all somehow the same. Children abandoned by mothers or fathers or both, raised by grandparents or not raised at all, whole childhoods spent caring for sick relatives in crumbling prison-like estates all south of the river, teenagers kicked out of school or home or both, drug abuse, sexual abuse, on the rob, sleeping rough, the thousand and one ways a life can be sunk in misery almost before it's begun. I remember one of them was a college dropout. Another had a 5-year-old daughter killed in a car accident the day before. They were all already petty criminals, and my mother was fascinated by them. She had a vague idea to write something about the case for what was, by that point, her PhD. She never did. "Have I annoyed you?" she asked, placing a hand over mine.
Two innocent boys walking across a fucking bridge.
As I spoke, I rapped my free fist on the table without meaning to, an old habit of my mother's. She looked concernedly at me and righted the toppled salt cellar.
But darling, who's arguing with that? We can't all be innocent.
Out of a corner of my eye, I saw a waiter, who'd just come out to check on the bill, tactfully withdraw.
Somebody has to be guilty.
Agreed, murmured Miriam, twisting a napkin fretfully in her hand.
I don't think anybody's disagreeing, are they?
They didn't have a chance, said my mother quietly but firmly. And only later, walking back across the bridge, when my bad temper had passed, did I see that it was a sentence moving in two directions. Part 4. Middle Passage. 1. The greatest dancer I ever saw was the Kankerang. But in the moment I didn't know who or what it was. A wildly swaying orange shape, of a man's height but without a man's face, covered in many swishing, overlapping leaves, like a tree in the blaze of a New York fall that uproots itself and now dances down the street. A large gang of boys trailed behind it in the red dust, and a phalanx of women, with palm leaves in their hands, their mothers, I assumed. The women sang and stepped heavily, beating the air with the palms, walking and dancing both. I was squeezed into a taxi, a beat-up yellow Mercedes with a green stripe running down its middle. Lamin was next to me, in the back seat, alongside somebody's grandfather, a woman feeding a squalling baby, two teenage girls in their uniforms, and one of the Quranic teachers from the school. It was a scene of chaos that Lamin met calmly, ever conscious of his status as a trainee teacher, his hands folded priest-like on his lap, looking as always with his long, flat nose and broad nostrils and sad, slightly yellowed eyes like a big cat in repose. The car stereo played reggae from my mother's island, turned up to a crazy volume, but whatever was coming towards us dancing to rhythms reggae never approaches. Beats so fast, so complex, that you had to think about them or see them expressed through the body of a dancer to understand what you were hearing. Otherwise, you might mistake it for one rumbling bass note. You might think it was the sound of thunder. Who was drumming? I looked out of my window and spotted three men, their instruments gripped between their knees, walking like crabs. And when they scuttled in front of our car, the whole traveling dance party paused in its forward momentum, took root in the middle of the road, forcing us to stop. It made a change from the checkpoints, the sullen, baby-faced soldiers, their machine guns held loosely at the hip. When we stopped for soldiers, often a dozen times in a single day, we would fall silent. But now the cab exploded in talk and whistles and laughter, and the schoolgirls reached out of the window and jimmied the broken handle until the passenger door opened and everyone except the breastfeeding woman tumbled out. What is it? What's happening? I was asking Lamin, who was supposed to be my guide, but he seemed barely to remember I existed, much less that we were meant to be heading for the ferry to cross the river into the city and onto the airport to greet Amy. None of that mattered now. There was only the present moment, only the dance, and Lamin, as it turned out, was a dancer. I spotted it in him that day, before Amy had even met him, long before she saw the dancer in him. I saw it in every hip swivel, each nod of his head. But I couldn't see the orange apparition anymore. There was such a crowd between me and it that I could only hear it. What must have been its feet pounding the ground, and the raw clang of metal on metal, and a piercing shriek, otherworldly, to which the women replied in song, as they, too, danced. I was dancing involuntarily myself, pressed up close to so many moving bodies. I kept asking my questions. What is it? What's happening? But English, the official language, that heavy formal coat people only put on in my presence, and even then with obvious boredom and difficulty, had been thrown to the ground. Everyone was dancing on it, and I thought, not for the first time in that first week, of the adjustment Amy would have to make when she finally arrived and discovered, as I already had, the chasm between a viability study and life as it appears before you on the road and the ferry,
in the village and the city, within the people and in a half dozen languages, in the food and the faces and the sea and the moon and the stars. People were clambering onto the car for a better view. I looked for Lamin and found him, too, scrambling up onto the front bonnet. The crowd was dispersing, laughing, screaming, running, and I thought at first that a firecracker must have gone off. A group of the women fled leftwards, and now I saw why. The Kankerang wielded two machetes, long as arms. "Come," cried Lamin, reaching a hand down for me, and I pulled myself up to him, clinging to his white shirt as he danced, trying to keep my balance. I looked down at the frenzy below. I thought, here is the joy I've been looking for all my life. Directly above me, an old woman sat decorously on the roof of our car, eating a bag of peanuts, looking like a Jamaican lady at Lord's following a day's cricket. She spotted me and waved,
"Good morning. How is your morning?"
The same courteous automatic greeting that followed me round the village, no matter what I wore, no matter who I was with, and which by now I understood as a nod to my foreignness, which was obvious to everyone everywhere. She smiled mildly at the machetes as they spun, at the boys who kept daring each other to approach the dancing tree and match its frenetic moves, while steering clear of its circling knives, imitating in their own narrow bodies the convulsive stamps and twists and crouches and high kicks and general rhythmic euphoria that radiated from the figure to all points on the horizon, through the women, through Lamin, through me, through everyone I could see, as beneath us the car shook and rolled. She pointed at the Kankerang.
"It is a dancer," she explained.
"A dancer who comes for the boys, taking them to the bush where they are circumcised, initiated into their culture, told the rules and the limits, the sacred traditions of the world in which they will live, the names of the plants to help with this or that illness and how to use them, who acts as threshold between youth and maturity, wards off evil spirits, and is the guarantor of order and justice and continuity between and within his people. He is a guide who leads the young through their difficult middle passage, from childhood to adolescence, and he is also, simply, a young man himself, anonymous, chosen in great secrecy by the elders, covered in the leaves of the Fara tree and stained with vegetable dyes. But I learnt all this on my phone, back in New York. I did try to ask my guide about it at the time, what it all meant, how it fitted into or diverged from local Islamic practice, but he couldn't hear me over the music, or did not want to hear me. I tried again a little later, after the Kankerang had moved on elsewhere, and we were all squeezed back into the cab, along with two of the young dancing boys. They lay across our laps, sticky with the sweat of their efforts. But I could see my questions were annoying to everybody, and by then the euphoria was over. Lamin's depressing formality, which he brought to all his dealings with me, had returned. "A Mandinka tradition," he said, and then turned back to the driver and the rest of the passengers to laugh and argue and discuss things I couldn't guess in a language I didn't know. We drove on. I wondered about the girls. Who comes for the girls? If not the Kankerang, who? Their mothers? Their grandmothers? A friend?
2.
When Tracy's time came, there was no one to guide her over the threshold, to advise her, or even tell her that this was a threshold she was crossing. But her body was developing quicker than anybody else's, and so she had to improvise, to make her own arrangements. Her first idea was to dress wildly. Her mother was blamed, mothers usually are, but I'm sure her mother barely saw or knew the half of it. She was still asleep when Tracy left for school, and not home when she got back. She'd found some work, finally. I think she was cleaning an office block somewhere. But my mother and the other mothers disapproved of her employment almost as much as they had disapproved of her unemployment. Before, she had been a bad influence. Now, she was never home. Both her presence and her lack of presence were no good somehow, and the way they began to speak of Tracy took on a tragic dimension. For isn't it only tragic heroes who have no choices before them, no alternative routes, only unavoidable fates? In a few years, Tracy would be pregnant, according to my mother, and so would drop out of school, and the cycle of poverty would complete itself, ending most probably in prison. Prison ran in the family. Of course, prison ran in my family, too, but somehow I was linked to a different star. I would be and do none of these things. My mother's certainty about all this worried me. If she was right, it meant her dominion over other people's lives extended far beyond anything I had up till now imagined. And yet if anyone might defy fate, as presented in the form of my mother, surely Tracy could manage it. But the signs were bad. Now when Tracy was asked to take her coat off in class, she no longer refused. Instead, performing the action with terrible relish, unzipping slowly and in such a way that her breasts were presented to the rest of us with as much impact as possible, barely contained by an unsuitable top that showed off her abundance, where the rest of us still had only nipples and bone. Everybody knew it cost 50p to touch Tracy's tits. I had no idea whether this was true or not, but all the girls united in shunning her, black, white, and brown. We were nice girls. We did not let people touch our non-existent tits. We were no longer the crazed things we'd been back in year three. Now we had boyfriends, chosen for us by other girls, in notes passed from desk to desk, or in long, tortuous phone calls. Want to know who fancies you, and told everyone he fancies you. And once these boyfriends had been formally assigned, we stood solemnly with them in the playground, in the thin winter sun, hand in hand, more often than not a head taller than them, until the inevitable moment came for us to break up. The timing of this, too, was decided by our friends, and the round of notes and calls would begin again. You could not take part in this process without belonging to a clique of willing females, and Tracy had no girlfriends left, only me, and only then when she chose to be friendly. She took to spending her break times in the boys' football cage, sometimes cursing them, even picking up the ball and stopping play, but more often than not acting as their accomplice, laughing with them as they teased us, never attached to any boy in particular, and yet, in the school's imagination, freely handled by all. If she saw me through the bars playing with Lily or doing double dutch with the other black and brown girls, she would make a show of turning and talking with her male circle, whispering with them, laughing as if she, too, had an opinion on whether or not we wore bras or had started our periods. Once, when I was walking past the football cage in a very dignified way, hand in hand with my new boyfriend, Paul Barron, the policeman's son, she stopped what she was doing, gripped the bars of the cage, and smiled out at me. Not a nice smile, a deeply sarcastic smile, as if to say, "Oh, is that who you're pretending to be now?" 3. By the time we'd escaped the Kankerang and passed through all the intervening checkpoints, and after our taxi had made it through the clogged, potholed streets of the market town and onto the ferry port, by then it was too late. We were out of time. We ran down the gangway but found ourselves stranded with at least 100 others, watching the rusty, hulking prow push forward into the water. The river split this finger of land in half throughout its length, and the airport was on the other side. I looked up at the ferry's chaotic three-story cargo. Mothers and their babies, schoolchildren, farmers and workers, animals, cars, trucks, bags of grain, tourist tat, oil drums, suitcases, furniture. The children waved at us. Nobody seemed sure if it was the last ferry. We waited. Time passed. The sky turned pink. I thought of Amy at the airport, having to make small talk with the Minister of Education, and of Judy in a rage, hunched over her phone, calling me over and over and getting nowhere. But these thoughts did not have their expected effect. I felt quite calm as I waited, resigned, alongside all these other people who seemed likewise to betray no impatience, or at least did not express impatience in any form I recognized. I had no network. There was nothing I could do. I was completely unreachable for the first time in years. It gave me an unexpected but not unpleasant sense of stillness, of being outside of time. It reminded me somehow of childhood. I waited, leaning on the bonnet of the taxi. Others sat on their own luggage or hitched themselves up onto the lids of oil drums. An old man rested on half of a giant bedstead. Two little girls straddled a cage of chickens. Periodically, articulated lorries inched their way along the gangway, shunting black diesel smoke down all our throats, honking to alert whoever might be sitting or sleeping in their path. But finding nowhere to go and nothing to do soon joined us in this wait that seemed to have no beginning and no end. We had always been looking out across the water for the ferry, and always would be. At sunset, our driver threw in the towel, turned his taxi round, inched back through the crowd, and was away. To avoid a woman determined to sell me a watch, I moved too, towards the edge of the water, and sat down. But Lamin was concerned for me. He was always concerned for me. A person like me should be in the waiting room, which cost two of the filthy, crumpled notes I had balled up in my pocket. And for that reason, naturally, he would not go with me, but still he was insistent that I must go there. Yes, the waiting room was certainly the place for a person like me. Why can't we just wait where we are? He gave me his agonized smile, the only kind he had. For me, it's okay. But for you? It was still 40 degrees outside. The idea of being in a room was nauseating. Instead, I made him sit with me, our feet dangling over the water, kicking our heels against the heaps of dead oysters cemented to the struts of the pier. All the other young men in the village had dance music on their phones, precisely to listen to at times like these. But Lamin, a serious young man, preferred the world service, and so, taking one earbud each, we listened to a story about the cost of university tuition in Ghana. Below us, at the shoreline, topless, broad-backed boys carried determined travellers on their shoulders through the choppy shallows to some brightly painted, perilous-looking narrowboats. I pointed to a very fat woman with a baby strapped to her back being hoisted onto the shoulders of one of them. Her thighs crushed his sweating head. Why can't we do that? We'd be across in 20 minutes. For me, it's okay, Lamin whispered. It was as if every conversation we had was somehow shameful to him and must not be overheard. Not for you. You should go to the waiting room. It will be a long time. I watched the beach boy, soaking wet now up to his thighs, lower his passenger onto her seat. He looked less pained, shifting this cargo, than Lamin looked simply talking to me. As it began to get dark, Lamin entered the crowd to ask questions, becoming another Lamin altogether, not the monosyllabic whisper he was with me, but what must have been the real Lamin, serious and respected by everyone, funny and loquacious, seeming to know everybody, greeted with warm, fraternal affection by beautiful young people wherever he went. His age mates, he called them, and this could mean either that he had grown up in the village with them, or that they had been in the same class in school, or else in his year at the teacher's college. It was a tiny country. Age mates were everywhere. The girl who sold us cashews in the market was his age mate, also a security guard in the airport. Sometimes age mates turned out to be one of the young police or army cadets who stopped us at the checkpoints, and that always felt like a piece of luck. The tension dissipated, they took their hands off their guns, leant in through the passenger window, and happily indulged in nostalgia. Age mates gave you a better price, issued tickets more quickly, waved you through. And now here was another one, a bosomy girl in the ferry office, wearing a confounding combination of items I had seen on many local girls, and looked forward to showing Amy, with the superior knowledge of the traveller who has arrived a whole week earlier. Skin-tight, low-riding, studded jeans, the skimpiest of vests, revealing the neon edges of a lacy bra, and a scarlet-red hijab, wrapped modestly round the face and secured with a glittering pink pin. I watched Lamin and this girl talk for a long time, in one of the several local languages Lamin spoke, and I tried to imagine how the simple answers we were seeking to the questions. "Is there another ferry? When will it come?" could possibly be turned into as involved a debate as the two of them seemed to be having. Across the bay, I heard a honking sound and saw a great shadowy shape moving towards us in the water. I ran over to Lamin and gripped his elbow. "Is that it? Lamin, is that it?" The girl stopped her chattering and turned to look at me.
She could tell I was no age mate. She examined the drab, utilitarian clothes I had bought especially for wearing in her country. Olive cargo pants, long-sleeved, wrinkled linen shirt, an ex-boyfriend's battered old pair of Converse, and a black scarf I'd felt sick